Israel vows to fight on in Gaza despite a deadly ambush and rising international pressure.
The head of Hamas has rejected a post-war plan for Gaza that would not include Hamas.
Plus, how will the U.S. House of Representatives impeachment inquiry into President Joe Biden impact the upcoming election year?
Like we saw during the Trump administration with a vote like this on the Democratic side, Republicans have voted now to sort of make clear that they have strong powers to get documents, to have witnesses come before them.
And the West African bloc ECOWAS is seeking to hold talks with Niger's military government and chart a course forward. Today is Friday, December 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Kim Lewis. Israel vows to fight on in Gaza despite a deadly ambush and rising international pressure, AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
The head of Hamas has rejected a post-war plan for Gaza that would not include Hamas. Ismail Haniyeh, the militant group's supreme leader, has said any plans for Gaza that do not involve Hamas are an illusion and mirage. The US wants the internationally recognized Palestinian Authority, led by Mahmoud Abbas, which administers parts of the Israeli-occupied West Bank, to also govern Gaza. Hamas seized power in Gaza from the Palestinian Authority in 2007. The US also wants to revive the long-defunct peace process to negotiate the creation of a Palestinian state. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government is firmly opposed to Palestinian statehood and has said it will maintain open-ended security control over Gaza. I'm Karen Chamas.
Heavy fighting has been raging for days in areas in and around eastern Gaza City. Jake Sullivan, the White House National Security Advisor, met with Israeli leaders on Thursday. The U.S. wants Israel to adopt a more precise strategy, using commandos to rescue hostages and kill Hamas leaders. My colleague Rick Pantaleo spoke with VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about these and other recent developments in the Israel-Hamas war.
What had happened is that Israeli troops installed these areas but didn't actually go inside them. And inside these areas were dozens, if not hundreds, of Hamas fighters waiting for the Israeli troops to come in, some of them hiding in tunnels that were built below ground. And Hamas still has thousands of fighters. The estimate that I heard today from a former intelligence officer was that there were a total of 25,000 fighters. Israel has killed about 6,000 fighters. Several hundred have surrendered, and that's something that seems to be happening more. But you're still talking about thousands of fighters who are hiding in densely populated areas. So Shajaiya, which you just mentioned, is in the north of Gaza. There's also Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza. So there's still a lot of parts of Gaza that Israel has not completely taken over. And so this has been perhaps among the heaviest fighting of the war so far.
Linda, Jake Sullivan, the White House's national security advisor, is in Israel meeting with leaders on Thursday. The U.S. is wanting Israel to adopt a more precise strategy, using commandos to rescue hostages and kill Hamas leaders. What have you heard about that?
So Jake Sullivan, according to the Israeli press reports, is saying that he would like to see Israel wrap up this phase of the war in the next few weeks, in something like 3 weeks, either the end of December, maybe the first week of January, and then to redeploy and to kind of maybe carry out commando raids, as you said. The issue is that not using air power is more dangerous for the soldiers. So it's not clear if Israel's going to want to be willing to do that or not. So anytime that it finds out where the hostages are, it carries out raids to try to rescue the hostages. So far, they've rescued several bodies of hostages, but not any living hostages, except for one fairly early in the war when they rescued one female Israeli soldier. So I think there might be a difference of opinion here between the United States and Israel, where Israel is not willing to do things that will endanger more soldiers.
And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu once again reiterated that Israel would continue its war until the hostages return home and Hamas is eliminated, kind of running contrary to what has been suggested.
Well, there's growing international pressure for a ceasefire, obviously. And so the UN Security Council had a resolution which the United States vetoed. The General Assembly had a resolution which passed, although, of course, General Assembly resolutions are not binding. But the opinion that Israel cares the most about is the United States. And the fact that Jake Sullivan is here now and Lloyd Austin is coming, I think, on Saturday. And then there's definitely sort of growing American pressure on Israel to try to wrap it up quickly. At the same time, President Biden has said that he supports Israel and he understands the Israeli issue. The problem is that the death toll among civilians in Gaza is increasing. The humanitarian crisis is getting worse. The Palestinian Health Ministry, which is run by Hamas, but their numbers have in general been fairly reliable, says that something like 18,700 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed. So there is a growing concern by the United States. And at the same time, there's also a growing difference between Israel and the United States about what happens afterwards, where the United States has said they'd like to see the Palestinian Authority playing a role. And Netanyahu has said he doesn't want to see the Palestinian Authority. He doesn't want to see Hamas, but hasn't really presented any kind of plan of what could happen in Gaza afterwards.
That was my colleague Rick Pantaleo speaking with VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. U.S. lawmakers are leaving open the possibility of reaching a deal on aid to Ukraine before leaving town for the holidays next week. U.S. senators continued negotiations Thursday afternoon over the White House's $106 billion national security supplemental request, which includes $60 billion in military and humanitarian assistance for Ukraine. We're following these other stories from around the world. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Thursday the Kremlin wants to reach an agreement on the return of American journalist Evan Gershkovich, who has been jailed in Russia since March on espionage charges that are widely viewed as politically motivated. On Thursday, a Russian court upheld a ruling to hold Gershkovich in detention until at least January 30th, 2024. The European Union has decided to open accession negotiations with Ukraine and Moldova. The decision was announced at a summit of the leaders of the 27 EU countries on Thursday. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky welcomed the move as a victory for Ukraine. The leaders of Guyana and Venezuela are meeting face-to-face as regional partners urgently seek to defuse a long-standing territorial dispute. The dispute escalated after Venezuelans voted in a referendum to claim two-thirds of their small neighbor's territory. Regional leaders have agreed to meet at the main international airport on the eastern Caribbean island of St. Vincent. A vote to formalize the impeachment investigation into U.S. President Joe Biden passed the Republican-majority U.S. House of Representatives Wednesday by a vote of 221 to 212. Republicans said the vote marked an important step forward in their months-long investigation into Biden's involvement in his son Hunter Biden's foreign business dealings. I spoke with John Fortier, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, about how this move will affect the upcoming 2024 election year. So, John, what is the next step for Republicans with this now formalized impeachment investigation of the president?
Well, in a way, the next stage is still investigatory. There are people in Congress who actually dispute whether Congress really needed this extra power, that maybe the committees already had the power to investigate. But like we saw during the Trump administration with a vote like this on the Democratic side, Republicans have voted now to sort of make clear that they have strong powers to get documents, to have witnesses come before them. So this is not an absolute decision to proceed with impeachment, but it is an indication that the House committees are going to be looking more clearly at a stronger investigation of the president, with the potential that down the road they might find that it reaches the level that they might have a vote for impeachment. The last thing I'll add is, you know, Republican majorities are very narrow, and it is not absolutely clear that they would be able to hold together all of their members. And so part of the investigation, I think, may be to buy some time, to put some more evidence on the table, to see if they actually have the votes at the end of the day to vote for impeachment.
House Democrats said the vote was politically motivated. ahead of the 2024 presidential election. So how will this affect or impact the upcoming presidential election?
Well, I think in some ways the impeachment and trials during the Trump administration and potentially one here are going to be seen as political in the sense that no one really believes that at the end of the day, the Senate will be able to bring a supermajority to convict the president. It is a simple majority in the House of Representatives, so one party can decide that. But nobody really thinks that likely the both parties will agree that really the president should be removed. So in that sense, it's more of a political issue. It may be that some of the investigation yields some information that is used on the political campaign. But at the end of the day, it is going to be more rhetorical, a question that Republicans will say, look, we're really digging into some of these problematic aspects of the Biden administration. And Democrats will say, yes, it's political. They're never going to be able to remove him. And ultimately, it's about election posturing rather than an actual legal issue that will have an effect.
Also on Wednesday, the president's son, Hunter Biden, refused a House Republican order to testify behind closed doors, saying he would testify in public and that he never benefited from his father's political connections. What are any consequences for Hunter Biden for refusing to testify?
Well, again, at this point, I think it is more of a political issue. Both sides will think they're in the right. It is possible that congressional House committees will subpoena him and try to use powers to really compel his testimony. And whether they can really compel it in private and not in public, I think some of these questions would have to be worked out in court. But it's perhaps the beginning of a back and forth between the House and Hunter Biden as to how much pressure they're going to put on to have him to be required to testify rather than simply requesting his presence, which he is chosen not to actually go before the committee in private.
That was John Fortier, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. A U.S. Navy officer jailed in Japan over a deadly car crash is transferred to U.S. custody, AP correspondent Rita Foley reports.
A Navy officer jailed in Japan after a deadly car crash is returning to the U.S., says his family. Lieutenant Ridge Alconis had been serving 3 years in prison in Japan after pleading guilty in the negligent driving deaths of two Japanese citizens in 2021. His family says it was an accident. He lost consciousness behind the wheel, but Japanese prosecutors say he fell asleep. His family rallied outside the White House to call for his release from prison, and his wife, Brittany, met with President Biden, who raised the case during a meeting in May with the Japanese Prime Minister. What's still unclear at the moment is whether Lieutenant Alconis might have to spend additional time behind bars here in the U.S. under the terms of his transfer from Japan. I'm Rita Foley.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Kim Lewis. The West African bloc ECOWAS is seeking to hold talks with Niger's military government and chart a course forward following the country's July coup that ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. The bloc is pushing for Bazoum's release and a shorter path back to democratic rule, but analysts worry they may not succeed. Timothy Obiezo reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
Niger is one of several African countries that have experienced coups or attempted coups in recent years. At a recent summit in Abuja, Nigeria, West African leaders from regional bloc ECOWAS agreed to negotiate with Niger for a, quote, short transition period to democratic rule, promising to progressively ease economic and political bands upon successful dialogue. Niger's military has proposed a 3-year transition period. ECOWAS wants a shorter transition and has set up a 3-person committee composed of the presidents of Togo, Sierra Leone, and Benin to negotiate with Niger's military government. During this week's summit, the fourth in 6 months, West African leaders also demanded the immediate and unconditional release of ousted Nigerian President Mohamed Bazoum. Kopep Dabgat, the General Secretary of the group West African Civil Society Forum, or WACSOF, questions ECOWAS's approach.
When you are having a negotiation, Normally, the difficult issues are the ones that come in last. The insistence of the release of the ousted president first at the preconditions, you know, for negotiation or other things, we think it is not very prudent. So we are calling on ECOWAS to lift, first of all, these economic sanctions as an act of faith, which will convince perhaps the junta to come back to the table.
This week's summit marked the first time the regional bloc has recognized the coup administration in Niger, dashing hopes of an immediate reinstatement of Bazoum. Senior military men in Niger in July overthrew Bazoum and have detained him for alleged treason. In response, ECOWAS imposed heavy sanctions on Niger. ECOWAS ordered border closures, assets freeze, trade restrictions, and threatened a military invasion of Niger. ECOWAS said it would ease the sanctions against Niger if the junta agreed to the bloc's demands. West and Central Africa have recorded 8 coups d'etat since 2020. Political analyst Chukwudi Odoeme says bad governance is the reason coups are receiving popular support in the region in the first place.
From the steps the military administration in Niger has taken, I don't see them backing down on the new line they have taken. But then again, ECOWAS has lost its beauty in the sense that the heads of state that populate them have a questionable hold onto power. And that's where the issue of legitimacy is lacking in the people who compose an organization. It becomes a difficult thing to hold on to whatever resolutions they have made. So I don't see any change coming from whatever ECOWAS is doing.
This week, Niger's transitional leader, Abdourahamane Chiani, said his government is forging a security and economic bloc known as the Alliance of the Sahel States with Mali and Burkina Faso, countries also ruled by their respective militaries. Dabogat says ECOWAS was too slow to conduct dialogue and that the new alliance would make negotiations more difficult.
Sometimes when you do not negotiate within the window that is available, things move further down the line and it continues to get difficult and difficult. You know, we have heard of the decision of the defense alliance between the Troika, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, and also the talk about eventually forming a confederacy.
Odoeme says if this alliance becomes successful, it could encourage more coups in the region.
If you have a good relationship with your immediate neighbors, you can survive any sanction. I am seeing a situation where other countries of Africa will tow the line of Niger and the rest of them.
It's not clear when the ECOWAS team will meet with Niger's junta. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Russian peace activists say authorities are stepping up restrictions on freedom of expression ahead of next year's presidential elections in Russia as Russia's war against Ukraine drags on. They point to the case of peace activist Alexandra Skoshelenko, who faces a 10-year prison sentence for expressing her opposition to the war. Marcus Harton narrates this report from VOA's Moscow Bureau.
Alexandra Skoshelenko is a Russian artist and peace activist who, at the beginning of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, went to a supermarket in her native city of St. Petersburg and switched the price tags of products, replacing them with anti-war slogans. That led authorities to charge her with discrediting the Russian army. And after a year and a half of so-called preventative detention, she has been sentenced to 7 years in prison, where we are told she is suffering physically and psychologically. The person relaying this is Sonia Sobotino, Alexandra's partner, who sees the future with pessimism, especially after the Russian government this month included the LGBT community on its list of extremists, along with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State militant group. Sobotina says she doesn't have any hope. She says the situation in Russia now is very difficult, and it's getting worse every day. Now, she says, she is labeled an extremist simply because she is a lesbian. It's something she says she has never hidden. And now she fears that the authorities may punish Alexandra for being an extremist, which can mean she gets up to 10 years in prison. Linguist Svetlana Drugovaiko was one of the experts called by the defense to examine materials used to accuse Alexandra. She said the documents presented as evidence were written without regard for the basic principles of Russian law. After presenting her expert opinion, Svetlana was removed from her position as a professor of language study, accused by a commission of professors of committing an immoral offense. Critics say Alexandra's prison sentence and Svetlana's expulsion from her job are a clear sign that the repression is now directed not only against politicians, but also against civil society at large. Russia has set presidential elections for March 17th of next year, and there is concern that restrictions on freedom of expression will be tightened further. The Yabloko party's Nikolai Rybakov says there are unfortunately many grounds to believe that after the elections, the situation will be more tough, and likely very much more tough. Hopes for pacifists like Alexandra that her sentence will be reduced seem very distant as Russia enters its second winter of war. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Kim Lewis.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Unprovoked attacks on commercial shipping and other vessels by Iranian-backed Houthi militants continue, threatening maritime security and international commercial trade. Among the latest were a December 11th missile attack on a Norwegian flag tanker in the Red Sea that caused a fire on board the ship, and a December 13th missile attack on a Marshall Islands flag vessel heading for the Suez Canal that missed its target. The attacks by the Houthis have escalated since the horrific terrorist incursion into Israel by Hamas on October 7th that killed more than 1,200 people and the subsequent war between Hamas and Israel. The United States has responded by coming to the aid of several ships in the area and by shooting down attacking drones and missiles. Pentagon Press Secretary Air Force Major General Pat Ryder said the United States takes the situation in the Red Sea extremely seriously.
The actions that we've seen from these Houthi forces are destabilizing, they're dangerous, and clearly a flagrant violation of international law.
This is an international problem that requires an international solution, said Major General Ryder.
We do continue to consult closely with our international allies and partners on implementing a maritime task force, and we will have more to provide in the near future. But we do continue to patrol the international waterways throughout the region to support freedom of navigation and efforts to ensure safety, security, and stability.
At a separate briefing, National Security Council Coordinator for Strategic Communications John Kirby noted that the Houthis are supported by Iran, not just politically and philosophically, but of course with weapons systems. So Iran is absolutely complicit here in what the Houthis are doing.
Our message to any actor in the region, state or non-state, is don't escalate, don't widen, don't deepen this conflict.
Coordinator Kirby pointed out that so far no actor has jumped in with both feet to help Hamas. So he declared, "We're going to continue to send a strong message, do additional force posture in the region, carrier strike groups, air missile defense, additional aircraft squadrons, and our willingness to use those capabilities to make it clear to actors in the region that we take very seriously our national security interests there."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.